I'm excited for this because there are a few people who I think have the real world practical experience that can see the abstract topics that we talk about so frequently on the show play out in the real world. I'm going to give us an overly academic introduction to the topic that I want to talk about today to start off, Honduras and Prospera. So if you were to go back, let's say, 50, nearly 100 years, and you looked at the writings of the neoliberals, their express goal was to set up a patchwork of special economic zones and facilitate capital flight out of the social democratic countries of Europe. Fast forward to today, they've been phenomenally successful at doing that. They're basically draining the welfare state of all of its resources. The most advanced sharp tip of the spear from that libertarian movement is this idea of the private state. We now see that abstract, theoretical, hyperbolic, ridiculous idea become manifest in projects like Prospera.
Many of your viewers will be familiar with the phrase, the Banana Republic.
Right.
Banana Republic refers to Honduras and the story of the United Fruit Company, basically exercising the might of its corporate interests to determine who would be in power to overthrow governments and install governments. And for a long time, that was the history of the relationship between the United States and Latin America. It was one in which the United States, under this Monroe Doctrine, now 200 years old, granted itself the exclusive right to intervene and manage the affairs of its hemisphere. So we saw that play out in many of the coups and military dictatorships of the 20th century, from Goulart in Brazil to Pinochet and the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile and elsewhere. And so this pink tide came to power as a way of bringing a stronger popular regulatory social democratic project to a region that had never had the ability, the strength, the force to impose those kinds of controls on capital and to regulate foreign business. Now, it's no surprise that the United States and the corporate interests of the United States did not like these pink tide governments.
I'm shocked.
And over the course of the pink tide, we're talking the early 2000s, kind of plotted their revenge in many cases. And that led to a second wave of, we might say, intervention. Some of them were military coups. Some of them were electoral coups that took place maybe about a decade ago that led to kind of the response to the pink tide, or kind of a reactionary tide. And one of the first instances of that was itself in Honduras. In 2007, an old rancher, kind of stalwart member of the Liberal Party, which is to say, these are not menacing radicals advancing a Bolivarian socialism in the case of Honduras. This was Mel Zelaya, who was simply trying to usher in that same social democracy you're describing in the European case into a Central American one, in that old Banana Republic terrain where U.S. interests had, people also forget that Honduras was a colony of the United States. But over time, Mel Zelaya, as president of Honduras, became aware that that in the introduction of social democratic reform in Honduras, the provision of decent wages and housing and education for the people of Honduras was going to run up against certain frictions with the United States, basically. And Mel Zelaya, told me once that he still calls Honduras a democracia tutelada, a tutelage democracy. And you can see that when you're in Tegucigalpa, in the capital. You know, when you fly into Tegucigalpa, you don't fly into the capital itself. You fly into Palmarola. You fly into a U.S. military base. And when you work in Honduran politics, as I have over the past years, you'll see not just the U.S. ambassador always on television, always making orders, always issuing declarations, but military service people who are kind of creeping around in, town. They're kind of figures in this, which is so sort of impossible for us to fathom here in the United States, another country having their ambassador intervene so openly and so brazenly, but also to having a military with such a presence there. Palmarola is the forward; it's the base of the U.S. Southern Command, which is our hemispheric military operation. And I give this background because I think it's important to understand what happened over the course of 2008 and 2009. Which is that over time, Mel Zelaya became increasingly convinced as president that sovereignty and social democracy for Honduras could only be won in kind of coordination and an alliance with other Latin American nations. that alone they were not individually powerful enough to take on a great empire, but together they might be able to coordinate, whether it's ranging from infrastructure, industrial policy, to simple kind of defense of sovereignty and questions of military. And the U.S. didn't like that. And so in concert, this is, we have to remember, in the Obama administration, 2009, there was a military coup in Honduras. In the early hours of the morning, Mel Zelaya was famously in his pajamas. They were airlifted at the presidential palace, and the military oversaw a coup in Honduras that was given the big okay from then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Why do I provide all of this background on the Pink Tide and its right-wing reaction, Honduras being the first battleground of that new reactionary wave that overthrew a lot of these Pink Tide governments? Because it was in the course of these 12 years of dictatorship that followed from this, beginning with the 2009 military coup and then followed in 2013 and 2017 by fraudulent elections. I'm not speaking now as some kind of crazy leftist. Mm-hmm. Everyone would recognize that these were flawed elections overseen by a convicted narco-trafficking president in the case of 2017, Juan Orlando Hernandez. We'll come back to the figure of Juan Orlando Hernandez a bit later, recently pardoned by Donald Trump on a whim, which I think is very related to this question of how the U.S. whimsically intervenes in Central American or Latin American affairs more broadly. But in the course of those 12 years, U.S. interests, a lot of these same libertarians and corporate entrepreneurs saw an opportunity. They saw a country that was suddenly open for business, that was no longer going to be pursuing the kinds of constraints or restrictions or regulatory proposals around how to manage private capital.
What might be an example of that? Are we talking about a country nationalizing its copper reserves, or like what is off limits to American business in this case?
Yeah. So in an extreme example, you have Bolivia. The Bolivia example is instructive. So before the Pink Tide, you had an agreement of revenue sharing between U.S. energy corporations, fossil fuel corporations, oil and gas, and the Bolivian state that was 88 and 12, which means that the U.S. corporations would take 88% and the Bolivian state would take 12. When the MAS came in, the movement towards socialism, that's Evo Morales, Alvaro Garcia Linera, as the duo who took over as president and vice president in 2005, they made a simple proposal to these U.S. fossil fuel corporations. They said, why don't we just invert the terms of the agreement? We'll get 88% and you'll get 12.
Keeps it simple.
Keeps it simple. And of course, every theory in the neoclassical tradition would tell you, they'll just flee and search for better regulatory conditions. But they didn't, because 12% was still making money hand over fist. And so they settled on a new kind of agreement. In the case of Honduras, in 2013, they passed, or the dictatorship pushed a special law, a special proposal called the CEDES. The zones of employment and economic development, in its Spanish abbreviation, the CEDES. These CEDES, these special zones, would effectively sell sovereign territory to foreign corporations to build these kinds of libertarian paradise of non-regulatory, crypto-governed, basically stripping away whatever remained or could have been built in the brief time of social democratic governance, of regulation around labor and in the environment, et cetera. Even at the time, in 2013, there was a recognition that this was unconstitutional. And so the president at the time sacked several members of the Supreme Court, installed lackeys in the Supreme Court so they could get the CEDES law through.
They just swapped out like four people.
That's right. And that and thus was born the CEDES. And the most famous of these CEDES is the Prospera case. Prospera Inc., the corporation, was very inspired by this idea of charter cities that is important to mention is not just some creature of the Silicon Valley lagoon. Charter cities was something that was being touted by the World Bank. It was a very polished proposal that was considered very acceptable in the annals of Ivy League economics, and Prospera Inc. itself was funded by Peter Thiel's capital outfit,
Pronomos Capital.
Pronomos, that's right.
Andreessen's in there too.
Exactly. And so they took over this land on the so-called Mosquito Coast, the Honduran coast of on the island of Roatan, the Caribbean island of Roatan, and thus set about kind of building a little bit of the infrastructure for what they hoped would be this crypto-libertarian paradise. Now, what makes the story of Prospera interesting is that in 2021, Honduras went back to general elections. And in this instance, Mel Zelaya, together with his wife, Xiomara Castro, and the movement of resistance that had been building over the course of 12 years of dictatorship, finally succeeded to break through those fraudulent elections, finally succeeded with such a sort of whopping majority in the 2021 general elections to come back to power.
Yeah.
This is a very glorious moment, not just for the Zelaya family, but for a movement that had been growing in Roatan from Garofana communities, people who were affected by, you know, Prospera's effectively invasion of this territory, just basically saying, you know, to these mostly Afro-descendant communities, a lot of them English-speaking, like, get out of here. This is ours now. Polluting the water, you know, obviously not caring about the quality of the construction on their ancestral territories. But in 2021, Libre, the party of Democratic Refoundation, of Liberation Democratic Refoundation, comes back to power, this time with Xiomara Castro as president. That's important because the campaign that they ran in 2021, a big piece of that campaign, a big plank of the platform was the elimination of the CEDES, was the restoration of a constitutional order that had been so deeply eroded over the course of 12 years of dictatorship. And so it was little surprise then, although I was surprised by the by what happened in January 22, that the Honduran Congress voted by consensus to eliminate the CEDES, right? It wasn't as if all of a sudden the right and the left and the center agreed on the malignant nature of the CEDES. It had to do with the extent of the social majority, the social consensus bubbling up from the ground in Honduras, that this was an unsustainable violation of constitutional order. This was such an obvious product of corruption, of narco-corruption, of an old school colonial corruption of the Honduran administration, that that's how they won this consensus vote in 2022. But as was the case in the macro sense of the Pink Tide and its reactionary counter-movement, Prospera was not going to take this lightly. Now, at the time, they had not really invested that much. I mean, Prospera Inc. had made a very fancy web page. They'd sold to the world that they were building the first real serious kind of charter city project. And it had gotten a lot of people excited, particularly the United States,
who were looking at
Central America, looking at places like, you know, a hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico as a place where they might be able to grab land and promote similar style projects. But Honduras was kind of an inspiration because they'd done it, and they'd done it according to their own kind of perception, legally, and sort of they could sell it as a kind of legitimate enterprise. But it wasn't as if they'd gotten very far along. I mean, all the evidence was in 2022, they'd kind of built a big building and stuck a kind of Bitcoin logo on the side of it and said, you know, we're building heaven on a Caribbean island, and people weren't living there. It wasn't a thriving community. And I, you know this much better than I do, Josh, but like a lot of these projects, Praxis Service, I mean, a lot of them have Instagram pages with fancy renderings, but they never get further than
AI cities and shit like this.
And they sell this idea, and a lot of them, you know, live here in New York City and kind of live in the fantasy of this, but they're not actually building these thriving utopian communities. It's kind of, it's pathetic in that way that is so, it's so flaccid in its aspiration. But in the case of Prospera, they were not happy to accept this democratic sovereign decision to sort of reclaim this territory and regulate it. And, you know, to the credit of Libre and Presidency of Xiomara Castro, they weren't saying we're expropriating you and there's no compensation. They weren't saying we're kicking you out. They weren't saying we're sitting in the army. They could have done any of those things.
You know how I feel about this. I admire the restraint.
They said basically, look, you can stay, but we're going to regulate you. We're going to bring you back into a constitutional order. This is not just a free-for-all. This is Honduran territory, a very uncontroversial claim. But they weren't happy about that. And so what they did, what Prospera Inc. did was take Honduras to the cleaners, really. I mean, they've filed a claim with the World Bank's Arbitration Court, also known as ICSID, in Washington, D.C., for $10.8 billion. $10.8 billion is two-thirds of the Honduran budget. So that's two-thirds of money that should be going to health, education, housing, roads, construction, everything.
It would, in effect, bankrupt the country.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And they knew that. Now, I think it's important to pause here and reflect on two things. One, how did they arrive at a number so astronomical as $10.8 billion? And two, what is this thing called ICSID? What are these shadowy arbitration courts in places like Washington, Paris, Geneva? Because they're relevant to the story that you set out at the beginning of the episode about capital flight and how it's regulated and how we might think about the story of neoliberalism in the 21st century. Let's start with the number of 10.8, because it shows a lot of the actually existing politics of corporate colonialism, I think. In 2017 maybe, Honduras signed, in the years of the dictatorship, a free trade agreement with Kuwait. Now, you may be asking yourself—
That was
yourself,
not what I was expecting.
You may be asking yourself—
This was going to end, okay.
You may be asking yourself, why?
Yeah.
Why would a small Central American country be signing, you know, in the high and heavy days of its dictatorship, a free trade agreement with Kuwait? Are these Kuwaiti investors investing so much in Honduran agriculture or coffee production? Well, I think one of the main reasons is that attached to that FTA, attached to that free trade agreement, was a clause of investor protections that was extraordinary. Because it granted investor protections for 50 years, which means that no matter what the government decides to do, raising minimum wages, improving environmental standards, changing building codes, the profits that would accrue to Kuwaiti investments would be protected for a 50-year time horizon.
A lot of continuity between regime changes and elections and everything.
I mean, that's crazy. I mean, say what you want, but, you know, it would seem to me a shocking negation of the premise of democratic politics to say for half of a century, no governments, left or right, socialist or social democratic, right fascist, could regulate away kind of Kuwaiti investments. Now, why is the Kuwait FTA relevant to the story of Prospera?
Yeah, what's the leverage here? How do they actually enforce it?
In the system of international trade law, there's a thing called most favored nation, the most favored nation principle, MFN.
Okay.
Most favored nation principle, supposedly at the level of WTO, was designed to kind of make sure that there was an even playing field between different countries that may be investing in other countries. So you couldn't give hugely preferential treatment to one country and discriminate against another country simply on the basis of the identity or nationality of the investor.
Okay.
MFN is a kind of race to the bottom principle that is disguised as an even playing field principle, which means that the 50-year investment protections granted to Kuwait in its FTA applied retroactively to the free trade agreement that Honduras had signed with the United States.
Jesus.
So how does Prospera get to $10.8 billion? They'd invested only some, maybe $100 million, maybe less, in the actual construction of this community, of this crypto-libertarian community on the Honduran coast. What they projected was over a 50-year time horizon, the expected future loss profits. This, now we're getting to a level of kind of
expected
fictitious.
Expected future loss
profits.
That's
the formal phrase. Expected future loss profits.
So technically just like shit you made up.
Shit you made up. Yeah, okay. You get your lawyers to go into a room and create an equation that basically says, well, we were going to do these businesses that were going to generate this revenue and these profits, and your regulation, which would equally apply, for example, if I raised minimum wages from $5 to $15, I could calculate in the difference between how much profit I'm losing in the $10 difference that I pay to my employees.
Well, if you're counting imaginary money, why not?
Exactly, and that I would be on the hook per international trade law. I would be on the hook, according to these strictures, to pay out those expected future loss profits in this case. And this brings us to the second really scandalous aspect of the Prospera story. Because I think there's oftentimes too much focus on the cretinous nature of Prospera Inc. And there is no doubt about their cretinous nature. But I'm more interested in the institutional form and the structures that enable, facilitate, and engine this kind of form of corporate colonialism. And that's the system of investor-state dispute settlement. So how can Prospera launch this case against the Honduran state? They do so through these arbitration courts one of which is ICSID. There's a number of others that allow for foreign corporations to sue states. Now, there's no opposite recourse. There's no way that states can sue foreign corporations. Many of us for a long time have been fighting for a binding law, something like a UN binding treaty on transnational corporations. There is nothing that exists to this effect. And, you know, I'll leave your viewers, listeners to guess the consequences of that imbalance of power. But states, whether it's because you closed a mine that you designated was too environmentally disastrous and was destroying the local community, whether it's because you went as far as to nationalize your resources, states have this legal recourse that's built into a lot of the international trade law, and certainly into CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement with the United States, that allows for these corporate firms to sue the states. Now, without getting too much into it, the real scandal is there. I mean, these are not real courts. These are corporate arbitration courts. The judges are themselves like corporate lobbyists and corporate attorneys. You know, there's no actual real oversight. And it's overseen by the World Bank. I think it's important to drag these, you know, glorious international institutions into the mud of this kind of nasty fight around Prospera, because they're not innocent. I mean, we shouldn't pretend as if there's one set of scrappy fights with actors and corporations like Prospera, and then in the high annals of global governance, like the IMF or the World Bank. No, they're very much party complicit in this story. And so the ISDS system, which has cost the Global South scores of billions of dollars, nowhere more than in Latin America. Honduras alone, since 2021, since Libre won the election, had 12 outstanding cases, ISDS cases, of foreign corporations suing the state for compensation for, again, light social democratic regulation. And so that was the fight that basically that Honduras was forced to fight on such horribly unequal terms. Now, here enters, you know, our organization, the Progressive International. 5 years ago, I helped to found this kind of 21st century international, taking inspiration from the first and the second international. We're a network of movements, parties, and unions all around the world, many of whom have their own experiences in taking on ISDS, and nowhere more than the Ecuadorians. Without going too much into the story of Correrismo, what happened in Ecuador, these guys were incredibly creative, incredibly courageous in how they took on foreign creditors, how they took on foreign fossil fuel corporations, how they dealt with the U.S. military, closing the U.S. military bases, and they got their own comeuppance in the return of a kind of narco state now in the former president, Daniel Noboa, close ally of Donald Trump. But, you know, we basically helped to bring together a committee of experts and policymakers, political leaders to support Honduras to leave ICSID, to basically say, we no longer respect the legitimacy of this arbitration court. We're leaving this treaty and, you know, we don't like deal with it basically.
Yeah, right. Why don't you just leave?
Exactly. And I bring this up because I think that oftentimes we understate the agency that a lot of southern countries have to execute unilateral and, if possible, coordinated measures to reclaim their sovereignty.
So what keeps them abiding by the laws of these courts?
Well, in one instance, and I think it's important to time this, we're still in the Biden administration when Honduras declares its intention to leave ICSID. So there's two things that prevent them from doing this. One is what happened to them with the Biden administration. So as much as the U.S. trade rep, Kathy Tai, at the time the Biden administration was touting a kind of new social and economic contract with poor countries of the world, they were, you know, themselves speaking out against the system of investor-state dispute settlement. Biden was himself opposed to it. There were a lot of allies on this. When Honduras did this, the U.S. government in the Biden administration kind of downgraded the investment climate.
Right.
So sending a signal, a kind of chilling signal. And in a very poor country that's very kind of vulnerable to the gales of the global economy and the winds of fortune, of foreign direct investment, this is a big deal when the U.S. government says, you know, we're downgrading our assessment of the investment climate in your country. We're reevaluating political and regulatory risk and sending a signal through the chambers of commerce that, you know, you may want to think twice about investing on Honduras.
They're basically telling the international business class that your capital investments in this country are not safe. There's a risk of it being taxed away, a risk of you being expropriated. And so they kind of use this as a hammer whenever these states try to claw back some of the value that's being extracted from their country. All of a sudden, they're like, oh, actually, we're going to throttle down the amount of money you get.
Exactly.
Incrementally, until you abide by what we want.
And the same kind of logic, the same attritional logic applies to the system of ISDS. So even if you leave the ICSID treaty and you no longer respect that court, these corporations have further recourse to take you here to New York to a secondary court where they can seek additional compensation. And if the U.S. government sides with the corporation, as has happened in the past, where governments, for example, in Argentina just said, you know, fuck you, we're not respecting this judgment, the U.S. government can and has simply seized assets from that government, whether it's a boat or a plane, and handed them over to the corporation.
So it is backed up by military force of some sort, that they'll just literally take your shit.
It's backed up by okay. the United States government in particular. And this is why I think the story of 21st century neoliberalism is impossible to tell without trying to, you know, make a triangular relationship between kind of the victims of these new kind of renewed and renovated forms of colonialism,
right.
The corporations who are the tip of that spear, and the U.S. government.
Right.
You can't tell the story. These corporations, Prosper Inc. doesn't exist without without the U.S. government, without the, you know, of course, the backing, formal backing that they've received. Heavily, I mean, they made a good bet on the new administration and Prosper Inc. and heavily
they
lobbying.
Sure did, yeah.
And the fruits of that process could be seen just a little while ago. I mean, we're speaking at the right time, Josh, to have this conversation around Honduras because just before the general elections that were held in November of 2025, there was a special hearing of the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee of the House that was presided by Maria Elvira Salazar, one of the most vicious anti-communist crusaders in U.S. Congress. This is a woman who has made it her life's mission to destroy not just the forthrightly socialist governments of Cuba and Venezuela, although she despises them plenty, but also the social democratic ones of Gustavo Petro in Colombia, for example, and Honduras was a special case. So for a long time, they'd been building this narrative that, you know, Libre, the party of President Xiomara Castro, who had derogated the CEDES law, was a menace to democracy. They were planning to steal the elections, and they held this special hearing about that. And so it was no coincidence that who pops up, but this Trujillo guy, this lobbyist for Prospera, who, to his credit, is pushed by Representative Joaquin Castro to be like, excuse me, is there not a huge conflict of interest here? You have been a lobbyist for Prospera Inc., and now you're standing before this committee talking about how the government that derogated the law and tried to regulate your sede is somehow a menace to the electoral integrity of this country. And, you know, what played out in the course of the general elections that have just transpired was exactly what we were warning of for so long. It was a playbook that's been written and played out across Latin America many, many times, which is, you know, the administration in the United States putting its thumb massively on the scale for its favorite candidate of the National Party.
Trump is threatening to withdraw funding if his guy isn't picked, yeah.
Trump, you know, blackmailed the people of Honduras to say, if you don't elect my guy, we're going to, you know, crack down on your country. He, you know, touted the virtues. He obviously doesn't know this guy who goes by Papi a la Orden, Daddy on Delivery, we might say in English. That was his slogan. Nobody, but who comes from this National Party that had been the party of the dictatorship and very friendly to U.S. investors, very friendly to Prospera Inc. in particular. And so it made sense that he was trying to tip the scales in that favor and going even so far as to listen to Roger Stone's advice, himself informed by his own allies in the Great Lagoon of Silicon Valley, to pardon Juan Orlando Hernandez, who had been convicted for 45 years in a New York circuit court on narco trafficking about 400 tons of cocaine to the United States, as well as lots of corruption in the course of the dictatorship. And surprise, surprise, you know, the votes swung in that direction. There's huge evidence of tampering in the electoral system, both in the count and in the digital kind of informatics and technologies that would do the process of accounting. So both at the level of, like, you know, thugs from MS-13 menacing voters of Libre all the way to the high electoral tribunal that was supposed to be overseeing the count. And it's playing out in a very old story, renewed for the 21st century. I mean, this is a simple story of kind of U.S. colonial Monroe Doctrine, or as Trump would have, the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, that we're seeing play out in places like Honduras, but not only in Honduras. We're seeing it play out, you know, equally heating up of the Caribbean Sea as we prepare for an armed intervention in Venezuela, as we prepare for a similar intervention in Cuba. The assertion of U.S. power kind of across the region. And it's not a coincidence that that's timed to the resurgence of a pink tide, to a second pink tide, when governments have come to power to push social democracy once again, following that reactionary wave I mentioned at the outset of the program, in places like Mexico, under the leadership of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, or now President Claudia Sheinbaum, Gustavo Petro, the first left-wing government in Colombia, of course, in Brazil, where Trump pushed these tariffs and you know, sanctioned the Supreme Court that oversaw the conviction of President Jair Bolsonaro for his role in the 2023 coup attempt. And so there's this, I don't want to call it a kind of too much of a pendular dynamic, but there is a way in which the ambitions, the social democratic ambitions of Latin America to reclaim its sovereignty, to sustain regulations that would be favorable to their people and less favorable perhaps to the healthy profit margins of U.S. corporations is always met by a counter movement, always met by a reaction to reassert U.S. control, to reassert corporate power on behalf of U.S. interests in the region. Honduras has been a particularly violent terrain for that to play out, not just in the past 10 years, but for the past 110 years, if not longer. But I would argue that we can see very similar struggles playing out all across the region.
This extension of private property rights into the sovereign territory of states is essentially the playbook of neoliberalism, right? What is the lever of power to fight? Basically, what we're talking about is the largest, most well-resourced, most powerful financial institutions in the world from clawing all of this value out of your country. What can you do to fight that tide?
I think there's three things that we need to do. And here I'm speaking both as someone who lives and works in Latin America, also as a U.S. American. The first is to do some narrative work, some myth busting. So it remains a very common trope that unless you massively deregulate your economy, unless you create these unbelievable conditions for U.S. corporations, your foreign direct investment will suffer.
Right.
This is the kind of myth making done by the bond vigilantes and by the threats of capital strike that are always issued around election time. You know, most famously, to give one example, Goldman Sachs made a Lula meter in 2002 showing the value of the real closely correlated to Lula's popularity rating to try to show basically, if Lula's elected,
right,
the real is going to crash in value. You know, this kind of message that gets in. We have to bust this myth. It's simply empirically not the case that there's a relationship between the regulatory environment for private capital and levels of foreign direct investment. On the contrary, it's when social democratic governments can guarantee a level of social stability, a degree of prosperity domestically, that oftentimes the spigot really begins to flow.
That's the great irony, is that the political instability caused by the lack of any social democratic infrastructure in these countries can actually be more disruptive to securing your investments in the long term, because you get these huge swings in what the political consensus is in that particular country.
And I don't want to be the apologist for any part of the kind of U.S. capitalist class who's conducting foreign investment, but we can make a distinction between the genuine vultures who really are just trying to make the quickest buck that they can. You know, the kind of private equity mindsets, and the industrialists, the people who are investing in making longer term investments.
Sure,
I think those people get it. But there are cases, and I would encourage your viewers to look at the empirical record of places like Ecuador, of Mexico. Now, I mean, it's simply not the case that when you have right wing governments that are supposedly favorable to the investment climate, you get more investment, or you get more. You can turn on some FDI switch to make the economy grow. So that's one piece, is we have to bust this myth. The second thing we have to do is we have to bring a lot of these issues out from the darkness into the light. This is more of a political project.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, these issues of financial colonialism, of investor state arbitration, of international trade law, we could spend the rest of the program just talking about tax treaties, another crazy way in which financial colonialism is exercised. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the amazing things about tax treaties, which just very, very briefly on this aside, are effectively, you know, Swiss cheese operations. They basically say, here's a tax code. We're going to carve out all these exceptions to the tax code. We're going to take this nice document that supposedly provides some degree of fiscal justice and just poke holes in it that allow for these exceptions. And one time I was told this remarkable story by a bureaucrat, a kind of faceless bureaucrat that I was meeting with. He basically said,
faceless bureaucrat.
He said, do you know why we do these tax treaties? And I was like, honestly, I really don't. And he was like, basically what happens is when we travel abroad, let's say we're going to the UAE or we're going to Nigeria or we're going to Pakistan, our president needs something to sign. We need some ceremony where we do something and we hold up the thing and we show that we've done something in that place.
Oh, God. Okay.
And so we use tax treaties as a way of, it's a gesture of good faith to their investor class to say, we're going to exempt you from these taxes. But the result is that the more we travel abroad, the less fiscal justice we have at home, which is itself, I think, such a revealing
I feel like there's an easy solve for this, yeah. To be honest. But
to me, a part of this, the second task that we have, if the first one is myth busting and narrative work, the second one is kind of political mobilization and getting people more educated about these things. If you're watching this program, I'm imagining you're somewhat scandalized by the things that you and I are discussing.
A lot of people just don't know about it.
Right. And that's not just true of, the America first worldist labor aristocracy. Mm-hmm. That's true also of kind of Latin Americans who are living and breathing and working in these environments, but they may know about issues of health and education policy that affect them in a day-to-day way, but they may not know because their governments or their bureaucracies may not be politicizing these things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one thing that the Ecuadorians did, for example, and I'll explain why I think this is so inspiring, is they brought that all of these issues of financial colonialism into a constitutional process, a constituyente. They rewrote their constitution in 2008 under Rafael Correa.
Okay.
And they put letter of the law. They said, well, you're going to vote on this. Mm-hmm. We're going to explain to you why these issues of economic policy, financial policy, regulation are epicentral to the story of our social democracy. And we're going to mobilize you, we're going to educate you, and you're going to vote on these things. And that was such an effective process that even when Daniel Noboa went back, the new kind of narco president, banana billionaire, went back to the Ecuadorian people and tried to make a special referendum on whether to bring back investor state arbitration, Ecuadorians voted no on that overwhelmingly because they had been politicized and mobilized towards the defense of their economic sovereignty against these kind of vicious forms of
financial. That was 2008.
And then the referendum was over a decade later.
Did it tank their economy? Did capital flee?
It did not flee. And Ecuador was the most kind of economically prosperous during that time.
Crazy
how
that works.
She was Thomasized. It's really important. This brings us back to the first case of narrative busting. Ecuador is a very important case for looking at. All these pink tie governments are important cases, I think. And the third piece, which is the most difficult one, and it's the one to which I've dedicated a lot of my life over the past years, is thinking about international coordination. One of the problems that we have in Latin America, which is true across the global south, is that these countries are highly integrated into the global economy, but highly disintegrated in their region.
Sure.
I'll give you a statistic to illustrate this. In the European Union, trade between members of the European Union accounts for about 60-65% of total international trade in the bloc.
Yeah.
In Latin America, the trade between Latin American nations accounts for 15%.
Right, right.
Which means that Latin America is basically ping-ponging, to the United States, to Europe, to China, And there's what that means is that they're highly vulnerable to, of course, economic shocks like the 2008 financial crisis, which transformed the fortunes of the region for sure. But they're also really vulnerable to regulatory changes in the United States, to new administrations. It means that the things that happen in Washington exercise an outsized influence on the affairs of Latin America.
Yeah.
So the third really critical task is a project of regional integration. And this is incredibly difficult, incredibly longstanding. I mean, it's an ambition.
So what does that look like?
Well, it's been tried before. It was tried in the Pink Tide. They made not just diplomatic organs like the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, but also UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations. And that's a very important project to understand. In many ways, this was being led by Chavez. Another reason why the U.S. really didn't like him was the idea of building greater regional sovereignty in Latin America, introducing a Banco del Sur, a bank of the South, to try to finance development in the South, building a coordinated defense system so that military men in Latin America were not getting trained at the School of the Americans under U.S. tutelage, mm-hmm. but were coordinating their own defense projects in Latin America.
Right, right.
They built this, and they built a headquarters outside Quito, right on the Ecuador, the equator, very symbolic, a beautiful gleaming silver building that's now just totally abandoned. You know, they advanced with these concrete projects of regional integration, and those can range from solar to trains. I mean, these are projects that if we look at Europe, for example, are seen as uncontroversial, the ways in which they coordinate to you know, defend and extend their economic sovereignty and economic prospects in a kind of turbulent geoeconomic conjuncture. And this is just really, really hard, in part because the project of regional integration, which should be uncontroversial, I mean, this is written into the Brazilian constitution, the pursuit of regional integration, has become so politicized or ideologicized, we might say, like it's seen as a left-wing project in many ways because of its origins and in kind of pushed by Chavez in coordination with figures like Lula and Correa and Cristina de Kirchner to advance this, that it's kind of dead now as a project. But I would argue that none of these countries are powerful enough on their own to take on, as it stands, the great, mighty United States. And it's only by exercising some coordinated leverage that they'll be able to strike back. And the U.S. Yep. knows this. I mean, Latin America has huge deposits of lithium, especially in the triangle, right. You know, Mexico, yep. Bolivia,
we need it for our
Argentina,
Tesla batteries.
Chile. And if they were to choose to do so, could cartelize that lithium, as we saw, for example, in the 70s with the oil-producing exporting countries, OPEC, who, you know, effectively, through that structural leverage, allowed the project of the new international economic order, shouting out to Quinn Slobodian in his episode, who did a great review of the NIEO. It was the structural leverage of these oil exporting countries that made the NIEO possible, even as a vision for, alternative vision for global economic governance. Latin America, if it were so choose, could come together, create a kind of lithium cartel. That sounds, you know, we've slandered that word, call it, an association of lithium producers,
whatever
to bargain
whatever
more
you want to call
and the U.S.
it, sure.
The U.S. knows that. Laura Richardson, who was then head of the U.S. Southern Command, again operating out of Palmarola in Honduras, was issuing these threats, say, you know, there's too many rich resources in Latin America for us to permit that kind of articulation. You know, legislation has been introduced in U.S. Congress about the menace of Russian and Chinese influence in Latin America as a means of defending U.S. dominance in the energy sectors of Latin America. We're seeing that play out in these questions of petroleum and gold in Venezuela, but they apply equally kind of to the rest of the region, where there's a lot of wealth, resource wealth, that is seen as kind of very central to the fortunes of U.S. investors, you know, here, who are cozying up to the Trump administration to push this new corollary to the Monroe Doctrine across the region.
Thanks for listening. This is an independent show. If you like this content, you can help to show your support by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can support the show on Substack or Patreon. Find me on socials at Joshua Citarella. This is a listener-supported show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.
Greetings, you Netflix one.